present the Millennium News Quiz with your chairman of a thousand years, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome to the second ever Millennium News Quiz. We start with an item spotted in the property section of Cave Paintings Weekly in January 1001, read by Lady Charlotte of Norfolk Sierra.
Glastonbury Dome, landmark circular structure of stone, for sale as a going concern. Includes the award-winning pebble, rock and grassy bit zones.
Let's meet the teams now. Please welcome first on my right Lord Andy of Hamilton and Mistress Linda, the wife of Erith. And challenging them on my left, Jeremy Hardy, Yeoman Stock and Herr Corran of Cricklewood. My Lord Andy, whose shot in the dark made the Bayer beware?
I have an inkling that this is about 1066 and all that in the Bayer tapestry, which, of course, we shouldn't believe because history is knitted by the winners. It's all a load of tosh, and the Bayer tapestry, it's propaganda. You can see it's phony, because for a start, why would they all be fighting in a straight line like that? Ridiculous. But it's, of course, the record of how William the Conqueror, or to use how he was known at the time, before he was a conqueror, he was known as William the Bastard. That was his... So he was probably a bit grumpy about that. And his dad, I think, was known as... Was it Richard the Devil? So that breakfast table must have been a lot of fun. But anyway, they swept in 1066, and the poor old Saxons, who I think were probably quite a nice bunch, who let women own land and things like that, got swept aside, and we all descended from these Frenchified Vikings. Or a lot of us are. I probably am. I don't know about Smith. I don't know. You're probably Saxon, aren't you?
I don't know. So you think you're descended from the Vikings? Do you do a lot of pillaging?
Yeah, when my schedule allows it, yeah. I don't know, probably most of the audience, I don't know.
You've got that slightly pixie-ish Björk look about you.
The great thing about the Bayer tapestry is all the real stuff of Harold falling over and William's conspiracies and goes on, for anybody who's seen it, who stood there in Bayer as I have and shuffled through with a death aid for 38 metres, all the big stuff goes on in the middle. And in the margin, real life goes on. It's like the end of Pews. And everybody has an erection. And it's full of people with erections stealing geese. And you realise... And the whole thing was knitted by nuns, was embroidered by... And she would say, do you think 14 centimetres? Yes. Mind you, with the battle going on, they couldn't half embroider fast. I mean, it's different from Saving Private Ryan, I'll tell you.
It wasn't at Hastings, was it? It was a place called Battle.
Say, only afterwards, I think.
If you go to Hastings and say, where was the battle then? They say, oh, no, it wasn't here, it was in Battle. They do. They deny any knowledge of it because they're embarrassed because of having caved in so shamelessly. They were so useless and their coastal defences. They were all cowering in amusement arcades.
The question referred to the Battle of Hastings in 1066. The English suffered greatly under Norman leadership, much as they were to do 1,000 years later under Norman Fowler, Norman Lamont, and most feared of all, Norman St. John Stevens. So 2 points to Andy, and we've got as far as 1067. Mistress Linda, who went to Canterbury and told tales?
Ah, well, who went to Canterbury was the pilgrims, but who wrote about them was Geoff Chaucer. Foremost poet of the English language. But the whole pilgrimage thing, now it all sounds very, you know, holy and everything, going on pilgrimage, but the first thing is where they all started off, where they all met up in Southwark, was a notorious place. It was just full of prostitutes completely and little cards in the phone boxes with younger, newer, blonder. All fetishly doth she dominate. The sort of place it was. And then they go off on this pilgrimage, which was a complete knees-up. They go off on it. It was like sort of Club 1340 to 1410 kind of thing. Go off on easy pilge, and the place, once they got to Canterbury, uncovered, there'd be all these con artists trying to sell them religious relics, just, you know, bits of bone from saints, and they'd be coming back with little T-shirts with, "My mum went to Canterbury and all she bought me was this lousy piece of the true cross." It was just a whole bonfire. But yes, Jeffrey, you're talking about Jeffrey Torch, sir.
Not much of a pilgrimage, is it? I mean, you think of Jerusalem or Mecca or Lourdes, but, I mean, you can get to Canterbury from London Bridge, can't you?
It's further in those days. You didn't have the Jubilee extension then, did
no,
you?
No, so I suppose
you
know.
Don't really have it now, do you? But
the tales began. "When the Aprila with his surest sweater, the drought of March hath perfed to the rotor." But, of course, no one speaks like that anymore, apart from Lloyd Grossman. 2 points to Linda. Hardy Jeremy, which Yorkie was made to walkie by Lancaster bombers?
Ah, well, I haven't read the papers, but I think I know this. This is all the War of the Roses, Houses of Lancaster and York. Now, most people are familiar with Shakespeare's Richard III, which, or in Rodgers and Hammerstein, made it into a musical called Seven Dwarfs for Seven Samurai. And, of course, it's all about dynastic power, Richard III. It starts with, "Now is the Windsor of our discontent, made glorious summer by the son of York." And Shakespeare, of course, is compounding two historical characters in Glorious Summer, which is Donna Summer and Gloria Gaynor. And he creates the one character of Glorious Summer. And it ends up, of course, on Bosworth Field, which is the end of the War of the Roses, when Richard III, staggering around, saying, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's horse, or fill this wall up with our English dead?" Now, I'm sorry, this disappoints me, because I had always assumed that Queen Elizabeth II reigned in our country, chosen by God, as a present for the baby Jesus. And it turns out the whole monarchy is based on a load of rich landowners just battering merry hell out of each other to seize power. And it's spoilt my Christmas, I can tell you.
When we get to the history of medication, will you answer?
I'm 38.
Yes, right. So 2 points to Jeremy, of course. Herr Corrin, please listen to this. Completely meaningless song, unless you realise it was sung by the Crusaders. Alan, who had a crusading zeal to spread the faith.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is the Crusade. There were nine Crusades, but we have no interest in any of them except the third, because it was the English one, where all these men went off in tin frocks, tramping across Europe, to spread the message of Christianity, of peace and goodwill and love, to the Saracens by lopping their heads off and coming home with their private parts inside their helmets. The great thing about the Crusade, it did wonderful things for the careers of people like Errol Flynn, Stuart Granger and Kevin Costner. What was happening while the Crusades were going on, and while indeed Richard I was straddling his troubadour, Blondin, so I believe. So it is rumoured, so Geoffrey told me. That night we had dinner together. While all that was going on, Robin Hood, Robin of Locksley, as played by all those actors, was back home in Sherwood Forest with Maid Marian and Trier Fuck and all those various people. And that's what the Crusades were really about, as far as the... shut up. As far as the English were concerned, there was only one. There were nine other crusades. There were children's crusades. There's a crusade, a man called William the Bald. It makes me feel there couldn't have been any people with hair in the 12th century when he went off from Norway. Because why would you call a man the Bald? There must have been other bald men. Anyway, I digress. It's about the Crusades. It also manufactured the chastity belt, I think. The Crusades were really about the chastity belt. It didn't exist until the 11th century, and it must have been. All these women locked together while their old men went out and rogered their troubadours.
I bet the locksmiths had a high old sex life at that point in history.
Yeah, and I bet they could charge what they liked for a call-out.
People knocking on the door in the middle of the night saying, "I've locked myself out." Man, quick with your wax impression.
Go on, do your wax impression. It's good.
I was just sitting here thinking, isn't it lovely when history is brought to life by people who know about it?
The idea of opening it with a credit card fills the head with strange images, doesn't it? Oh, lost my credit card. No, that one doesn't give cash, but that... Yeah, hang on, it'll come out again.
So, 2 points to everybody. The scores at the end of the 14th century are everybody 4 points. We start the 15th century with an item spotted in the Exchange and marked.
Chastity belt for sale. Very good condition. One careful lady owner. Contact Joan on ARC 7261.
And thanks to the lads at the Aix-en-Provence Fire Brigade for sending that one in. Andy, whose Catholic taste in women gave him a head start against the church?
Well, this is poor old Henry VIII, who I think has been badly treated by history. He's remembered as this cruel monster, but I think if he were around, he just didn't really receive the kind of counselling and and support networks that he would now. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about what he might have been suffering from, what illnesses, but now it's pretty clear. Psychiatrists are agreed that he was suffering from something known as wife rage. And, you know, he's been remembered as this horrible sort of creature, but he did. Without him, we wouldn't have had the Church of England, of course, because, I mean, he realised that there was gold in them, their monasteries, decided to close those down because the Pope wouldn't approve his divorce, you know, because he wanted Marie Anne of a Thousand Days. I don't think he told her that was her title beforehand. And all he, you know, all he really wanted was to father a son who could continue the dynasty. And he became so disillusioned, he got very, very fat and ended up being played by Charles Laughton.
Can you remember the rest of the wives? Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah.
Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
Sarah Ferguson.
Yeah.
There was the one that he thought was very beautiful because he saw a painting by Holbein, Anne of Cleves, was it? Where she was this vision of beauty. And when she turned up, she looked like a horse. Or a Flanders mare, was it? He called her, or something like that.
If Henry VIII had been able to commit to a long-term relationship then, this country would still be Catholic and we'd be able to take our children into pubs.
That's true. And also... If
and get them into schools that have books.
Yeah.
I think if he'd been around today, you know, he would have received a lot more help. He would have probably been the centrepiece of a special edition of Oprah. You know, Men Who Behead and the Women Who Love Them.
And all the women that married him, I mean, all their friends must have been saying, "You're mad, look at what he's done to his other wife." And say, "Oh, he's not like that when he's with me."
Were they all saying, "I can change him, I can change him"?
Yes, the relationship between church and state was changed forever by Henry VIII, the Steve Norris of his generation. So, 2 points to Andy. And Linda, which Busy Lizzie came up against an armoured and dangerous enemy?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Queen Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, though apparently Virgin Smirgin, to be honest, and the Armada. And she did that, she went to, because there's this whole business of Francis Drake, was it? I get him mixed up with Walter Raleigh. Which one is the one who invented Spud, you like? One of them did. Never quite sure.
Raleigh invented the bicycle.
Oh, right. That's it. Raleigh invented the bicycle.
I think Raleigh ate tobacco and smoked potatoes.
That's the
one.
He
was dim. He was a good importer, but dim.
It's a funny old do, really, because she had syphilis.
Congenital.
Wasn't he her dad?
Yes, that's right.
That's how
hereditary works.
Yes, I think you'll find when you come to Joseph Bramah and the water closet in 1900 that Henry VIII and Elizabeth both lived at a time before there were lavatory seats. So there is absolutely no way in which they could have got syphilis, according to my father.
Ah. And she was bald. She had a ginger wig. And she had a really white face because she put all this makeup on that made her look deathly white, which had lead in it, which gave her some illness, lead poisoning, I suppose. And so she was a bit of a 2 and 8, really, but she was known as this sort of great beauty.
If you had to get a wig, would you choose ginger?
No, quite. That's it. I think she was operating on that sort of Terry Wogan sort of realism thing. Because when she had hair, she was ginger. She was the original Ginger Spice. So she thought, if suddenly she's a blonde or a brunette, it would look a bit fishy, so she had to get a ginger wig. She was trapped in the ginger wig, really. That was, she had no way out.
Probably why she was so bad-tempered.
Probably was, yeah. She was walking around looking like Ronald McDonald. Might put you in a bit of a bait.
She had a long-standing affair with Essex. Some party, that
David
was.
David Essex!
She was drawn to Essex by his white high heels and his big handbag, I think.
Well, I think it's a bit much, because she can't answer back.
What, because of the syphilis?
That's what we usually say.
Oh, and that's another thing. All her teeth had gone rotten.
Oh, please.
So she used to put, this was a common practice in the time, she used to put bits of cork in her mouth to sort of fill her cheeks out a bit, so she would talk like Marlon Brando in The Godfather. But if she laughed, if suddenly someone like Essex or whatever made her laugh, she would just shoot this cork out and she'd just have people's eyes out. Andy's looking green now.
That's how champagne was invented then. She's responsible for Formula One racing.
I'm not seeing Judy Dench here, are you? Not even Flora Robson. No, I get it.
Jeremy, listen to this. Watch out! You might get what you're after. Cool babies. Strange, but not a stranger. I'm an ordinary guy. Burning down the house. Burning down the house by Tom Jones. Jeremy, which guy, etc., etc.?
This refers to Guido Guy Fawkes, who was the inventor of the firework code, an early means of communication using gunpowder, and it's still the most effective way of contacting your MP. They tortured him because he tried to blow up Parliament because they were picking on the Jesuits, and him and Catesby had a plot. Except there's evidence to suggest they were fitted up in order to... ...your late jacket potatoes and go and stand on the common.
Yes, Guy Fawkes in 1605, together with a group of Catholic conspirators, failed in his attempt to blow up the House of Lords. He made his crucial mistake to eradicate the Lords when he offered them a chance to survive by writing a 75-word letter explaining why they should be. So before we leave the 17th century, here's a weather report spotted in the Stratford Times.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
Thanks to Mr. W. Shakespeare of Stratford for spotting that one. And the many other people who sent it in, including Mr. F. Bacon, Mr. C. Marlowe, and the Earl of Oxford. Alan, which British scientist made us fully aware of the gravity of the situation?
Well, yes, he's the greatest scientist who ever lived. Legend has it that he was sitting under a tree one day, and a fig fell on him. He invented the fig Newton. Perhaps one of the greatest biscuits in this country. It's Sir Isaac. And the other thing he invented was calculus, without which it's almost impossible to make gallstones. That is a joke for those of a medical disposition. No, but it's Sir Isaac's thing. It's gravity and all that, and the first law of thermodynamics and all those things we really pretend to know about, but I don't.
He was sitting under the oak tree, and Charles II fell on him. Because there he was, Isaac Hayes, sitting in his bath, eating his curds and whey, and up came a spider and said, "Turn again, Robert the Bruce." And then out came the sun and dried up all the rain, and the itsy-bitsy spider climbed up the spout again. And that's why to this day we wear cardigans.
It's like AJP Taylor just walked in then. I know very little about gravity as well, but one of the things, very, except on a Saturday night, but What's interesting is we only think of downwards gravity, don't we? The gravity we experience when we fall over and stuff. But in fact, every object in the known universe has gravity. So if I hold out this pen, because my mass is a little bit bigger than that pen is attracted to me. This is science, don't giggle. I'm telling you, that's a fact. That actually, it's quite attracted to me because I'm a lot bigger than the pen is.
Certainly now, standing up very straight.
Yeah, it is. But
is that why you always see Michael Winner with really slim women?
And a lot of pens, maybe, yeah. That's right, yeah. But also, to an infinitesimally small degree, that pen is attracted to me. It's a good thought, that, isn't it? That pen. It's fighting the attraction quite hard at the moment. But. So every object in the universe, apart from David Mellor, every known object in the universe...
Andy, that pen and you are working together. It's a doomed relationship. You're going to have to be strong. The pen is going to have to learn to deal with its attraction somehow or another. Plus, there's a whole power thing going on there, because you're very much in control of it, aren't you?
I'm just trying
men
to...
Men who love to attract and the pens who love them.
Of course, later Freud went on to discover pen's envy.
They laughed at Newton. You can laugh at me all you like, but I'm telling you, that pen is a bit attracted to me. You can't measure it, obviously, because the
pen... They only laughed at Newton live because his club act was very blue. Gravity, my arse. Like gravity, everyone's arse at a certain age.
Newton was greatly influenced by the scientific verity of Boyle's law. Boyle's law states that the volume of a body of hot air increases exponentially when you and yours is doubled in length. One for the Radio 4 fans among you. Oh, Andy, which novelist filled us with pride and prejudice?
This is Jane Austen, marvellous writer, and modesty forbids me, but I've quite often been likened to Jane Austen. No, seriously, if you shave my beard off, stick a bonnet on my head, I'm a dead ring, and I, as a child at Butlin's Holiday Camp, every year I won the Jane Austen lookalike contest. But of course, she is remembered as this wonderful writer of psychological drama, and the fantastic thing about Jane Austen is that, like all great writers, she knew the value of the rewrite. She wrote many, many drafts to get it perfect. And I think
Publisher told her to take out all the effing and blinding.
That's right. If you go along to the British Library, I think they may even have some of the early manuscripts of Pride and Prejudice, and you can see the things she cut out, like the bit where Darcy and Elizabeth end up on the run from the police and go on a killing spree in Lyme Regis. And there's Emma, she completely... the first draft of Emma... was just, they all got eaten in the woods by this alien monster that craved crinoline. But she is undeniably the great trailblazer for the novel in this country. And unfortunately, in those days, of course, it wasn't considered ladylike to be a novelist, so she didn't actually... I mean, the first books, four or five books, were brought out anonymously and immediately claimed by Geoffrey Archer as his work.
Correct. Jane Austen has once again become fashionable thanks largely to Hollywood versions of her work, such as Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. 2 points to Andy. Linda, your piece of music. French General Linda had a beef with the English.
Oh dear, that was stirring, wasn't it? Napoleon. He met his Waterloo with Duke Ellington, wasn't it? Who defeated him where others failed because he could really swing. Yeah, it was a sort of immensely successful military leader, very powerful and... Famously, of course, he was married to the Empress Josephine, and he wrote that letter to her, didn't he, when he'd fresh from one of his battles, he'd won his battle, he said, right, I've won my battle, I'm off home,
don't wash. Because you like to not wash and go.
Is that true? He said yeah. Don't wash?
Yeah. Silver-tongued type, wasn't he?
Oh, I'm feeling faint again.
This is bringing out the Jane Austen in Andy here, isn't he? He's had a bit of the vapours. She'll have to take him to Bath for the season.
Who did mad people think they were before he was around?
Exactly.
Wasn't he poisoned by his wallpaper?
He was poisoned by his wallpaper. Also, his wallpaper was starting to change him into a woman when he died. There was
He was buried in Les Invalides without his private parts. His private parts were auctioned at Sotheby's in 1968. Do you know that?
Well, they were auctioned,
his doctor removed it.
They were auctioned but never sold. It was withdrawn.
It was withdrawn.
They preserved these things for the.
Because of the poisoning, he was I won't say dissected. He just sounded like a frog, which he was. there was a post mortem after he died to see whether they ought to go on buying this wallpaper or not, and he died of arsenic, which he got from the wallpaper. But they removed his private parts because what he had was syphilis, and they wanted to keep this from the people who were laying out the body.
God, all of that from his book. Got syphilis, changing into a woman.
And you could have bought it at Sotheby's 30 years ago. Wouldn't you want it? It's Napoleon's willy. It's keep away from it, though, and don't put it anywhere near the lavatory seat.
So he got.
I tell you what, he'd be suing changing rooms, wouldn't he? God. That Lawrence Llewellyn poem has really done it this time.
Sounds a bit paranoid, doesn't it? I think the wallpaper's poisoning me. He comes off the wall at night and puts arsenic in me hall.
But that said, those were, we're jumping forward several centuries, they were Oscar Wilde's last words.
Well, I think the wallpaper's poisoning me.
No. What he said was, either that wallpaper goes or I do. And that's his last words, and then he died.
That was more of an aesthetic thing, though, wasn't it?
I don't think it poisoned him.
So did he get syphilis off his wallpaper, then?
Well, he was a lonely man on that island.
Hence the expression Harvey Wallbanger.
Or I suppose a flock will be out of the question.
Napoleon married Josephine Tashler Boani in a civil ceremony in March 1796. She was on the verge of bankruptcy, which explains why there was a little surprise in Paris when hundreds of exclusive sketches of their wedding featured in the first ever edition of Bonjour magazine. Jeremy, who followed a tea party with a rapid constitutional?
This refers to the American Revolution. And this was all the fault of George III, who these days we have rightly diagnosed as being a raving lunatic, but in those days he was simply written off as a member of the royal family. And he imposed punitive taxes because he had lost all his money in the war against the French, and he imposed taxes on stamps, like legal stamps, and then tea and paint and all kinds of things. And there was rebellion, rebellious mood in the country, and there was a massacre in Boston where the demonstrators threw snowballs at the army, and the army retaliated by shooting them. And there was a big lot of fighting and that, and England then had to leave and give America independence. And, of course, after that, I mean, once Britain left, whole thing fell apart, didn't it? I mean, the infrastructure fell apart, the country became incredibly poor, and I don't think anyone's heard of America since then. See, without us, you see, these countries just can't cope. Bless them.
Americans did cheat, it has to be said, in that war, because they hid behind trees and shot at our boys, whereas our boys obviously marched in nice straight lines in red coats, which is the proper way to fight a war. It's a very rich and colourful period. It's like the Ryder Cup all over again. Apparently, long before the battle was over, the wives were out there celebrating. Completely through our boys.
British used German mercenaries, you know.
Our boys were all German, that's right. They were Hessians.
Do Just mate, dressed in that sacking material.
From Hesse.
The American War of Independence was opposed in Britain by William Pitt, one of the three famous politicians with that name. William Pitt the Elder, William Pitt the Younger, and William Hague the Pitt. Alan, which revolution left its workers all in a spin?
Oh, right. It's rather like, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. I think it's the Industrial Revolution, where the people of England, who had been oppressed by lying around in haystacks with milkmaids and living in the country under the sun, rushed into the streets and demanded to be poked up chimneys and thrown down mines and working 18 hours a day in sweatshops so that people could make a few bob and Huskisson could lay a railway and be run over by it. It's the Industrial Revolution, which is now over, I'm told. This all ended up as the M25. I don't know where we went wrong.
I've always thought that Huskisson's death was the great comedy death, because to be a politician, he was actually opening the railway line, wasn't he? He was there, he cut the ribbon, said, "I now declare this railway open," and they ran over him. And he was the Secretary for Trade and Industry, wasn't he? It's the equivalent of Peter Mandelson opening a train line and being run over nowadays. Think what a story. What fun they must have had on the news quiz that week.
You know, the inquiry into the Huskisson disaster is still going on.
Yeah, Al-Fayed says Prince Philip did it.
I think Mandelson's all right, though, isn't he? I think he's safe, because the Jubilee line doesn't actually stop at Westminster yet, does it? He'd have to be a bit nippy, wouldn't he, to get run over by that?
Yeah, he could get run over by something, though, I'm sure. Just needs a bit of thought.
Yes, it's an Industrial Revolution. An article published in 1790 described harrowingly women at one Lancashire cotton mill with their complexion sallow and pallid, their limbs slender, their chests hollow. Action was immediately taken, and they all signed lucrative modelling contracts with Gucci. And amazingly, at the arrival of the Victorian age, everybody has 12 points. And after what feels like marginally less than 900 years, we head for the 20th century with a conversation overheard in a greengrocer's.
"I'll have two large melons, a banana, and some sex, please."
Many thanks to Mr. S. Freud of Hampstead for sending that in. Andy, your piece of music. Theme from the Magic Roundabout. Andy, which Florence worked her magic roundabout this time?
Well, given that I've already nearly lost consciousness a couple of times during the very detailed discussions of illness, and as the resident hypochondriac on the panel, I think it's rather cruel to bowl me a question about Florence Nightingale. And now, what I know about Florence Nightingale, she was the founder of modern nursing. She wrote the definitive book on how to be a nurse, you know, with things like how to say, "How are we today?" in a loud voice. How to tell the relatives there's too many of them round the bed. That kind of thing. But what's remarkable about Florence Nightingale is that her whole career, she always claimed that she heard the voice of God in her head telling her to go to the Crimea and nurse and to found nursing and reform nursing. And I think that's rather sweet, because usually when people hear the voice of God in their head, it's saying, "Go and blow away everybody in the supermarket." So I think that's rather touching. The other inspirational thing about her is that although as a young woman she developed theories of nursing and then went to the Crimea and became a national hero in the hospital at Scutari, after she came back, she went to bed. And she really didn't get out of her bed for about 50 years, I think it was. She made everybody come to her. But she achieved the most enormous amount. She managed to get colleges of nursing founded. She got the whole of the sanitation of India completely reformed. And she did all that lying in bed. And that's why I've always admired her. And any teenagers out there listening, Next time your mum says to you, you've been lying in bed all Saturday morning, you'll never achieve anything like that, just say, oh, Florence Nightingale, mum.
Florence was named after the city where she was born. As she grew, she was eternally grateful her parents had moved 3 weeks before from Scunthorpe. 2 points to Andy, of course. Linda, whose theory had mankind going ape?
Darwin. Theory of evolution. Natural selection, isn't it, I think? Although, of course, evolution, he didn't invent evolution. He just found a plausible kind of mechanism for natural selection. Andy nodding very wisely there. Mm. You knew that, didn't you, Andy?
Yeah, my pen knew that.
Your pen knew it. Oh, it's a bit nearer to you now. Oh, blimey. There was a lot of talk about evolution at the time. But he came up with this idea of natural selection, that new species come about because the environment changes. And so, therefore, different characteristics... You're listening. Different characteristics then become more important. So you get sort of, you know, new labour, new species is what you get. But this was quite an unacceptable theory in Victorian times and in America, where it's still not quite that accepted, is it, really?
No, you can get prosecuted for teaching it, I think, still in some states, or... Because we're not just descended from monkeys. I mean, that's the thing, is everybody focused on that. But if you take the theory to its logical conclusion, we're also descended from tiny organisms that were formed at the bottom of the ocean. And they have apparently found, I think it's a gene connected with the eye, that they found in squid. So we are descended from squid as well as... I mean, obviously some of us are more like squid than others. Personally, I don't feel at all squiddy. I mean, I can see me as an ape. I can see that.
And he never said the survival of the fittest either. That's a misquote, like Humphrey Bogart never said, play it again, Sam. He never said...
That's the Krypton factor. It's nothing to do with Darwin.
Absolutely, nothing to do with him.
I'm so bored you've converted me to creation.
Darwin's great support.
I nodded off. I woke up and she said, Darwin never said, play it again, Sam. I thought I knew that. I don't think Ingmar Bergman ever walked into a bar where Darwin was playing the piano. Or...
Ingmar Bergman wasn't in the film.
I know that. I'm trying to do a little bit. Something has rubbed off you.
There are a number of
Bergmans.
I never know with you, Alan.
You two are illustrating natural selection perfectly. Living experiment in it.
Darwin's great supporter was Thomas Huxley, who was called Darwin's bulldog due to his stout defence of the great naturalist and his tendency to urinate against lampposts. 2 points to Linda. Jeremy, can you break the deadlock? Which favourite old auntie received a wreath at her birth?
I have absolutely no idea.
Thank God.
I shouldn't be telling people this because they could come to the BBC Experience here at Broadcasting House and learn all about it. Because if you've got an intelligent child with a lively and inquiring mind and you want to punish them, fetch up at the BBC Experience. Because it destroyed my 9-year-old summer, the 3 hours we spent in there this year. What a bloody miserable thing. That thing on the front of Broadcasting House, an old long-haired man leaning over a child. Now, you thought that was Jimmy Savile, but apparently it's Prospero. I learnt this, and that's Ariel. And the film wasn't ready for us when we arrived. The video was broken, so they had to entertain us for 20 minutes. And this woman came out and said, we'll have a little bit of a chat with you before we take you through into the experience. And now, there are 5 national radio channels at the BBC... And can anyone name them? Does anyone know the name of the first one? Radio 1. Yes, that's right, Radio 1. How about number 2, anyone? Filled 20 minutes.
Just 3 weeks after the Beeb's birth on December the 4th, 1922, Lord Rithjody wasn't afraid to make the tough decisions that mattered. He controversially banned Cliff Richard's first ever Christmas single. At the end of 1922, the BBC had only 4 employees, the Director-General, Lord Reith, and 3 management consultants telling him he needed more lifestyle vehicles for Carol Smiley. Back in 1923, many feared the corrupting nature of radio. One politician warned that an upcoming BBC broadcast, this is a quote, had the power to drive men to a frenzy. Years later, the shipping forecast was given over to Charlotte Green. Alan, who did we fight first in the trenches, then on the beaches, and finally at the poolside?
Why me? Hey, we did it twice. Well, the first time it was a great war. The Germans didn't think it was a great war. It was a good war. It wasn't great. Do better next time. I feel trapped here because I think you want me to say unpleasant things about
people.
I like and admire almost as much as I like and admire Muhammad Al-Fayed. But I know this is just about the Second World War. I don't want to say anything more about it. It put its seal on the millennium. It made it the nasty thing it was. You want jokes from me about the Krauts, don't you?
Well,
you know how to get them.
Alan, that's what we live for.
Yeah, I know. We had all that hair corn stuff at the start, and I thought it's leading up to that, but I will not be drawn into this. That's my last territorial claim on the news quiz. I'm not going to be drawn to jokes about.
We have the finest medical minds in the world keeping you alive. And you won't deliver.
I won't deliver, no.
Not even the tiniest little beach towel joke?
No. I'm going to be coy about this.
He's going to go out and stick a screwdriver along the side of a VW, aren't you?
Well, I've done all those gags since I started at the beginning of the millennium on the news quiz, before all these other people. I've done all my German jokes.
Well, don't your impression of Winston Churchill, then?
Winston Churchill was actually done by an impressionist in this very building. It's actually true, they got an actor in to come in and do Churchill, and people didn't guess.
Norman Pickles, he was called.
Yeah.
Brother of the more famous Wilfred.
He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I was at a Hollywood party the other day. And who should I bump into?"
It wasn't Norman Pickles. It was he played Winnie the Pooh later, but he came in and someone asked him, "What is your impression of Winston Churchill?" And that was the beginning of the end.
Be nasty if he got confused doing Winnie the Pooh. Christopher Robin. Come to the wood. You see, now... All right, you'll go, Linda. You've been practising many weeks.
Well, you know, I do 10 minutes in the live act. Actually, it was Winston Churchill who famously said that... Oh.
He said it in the form of an announcement.
Yes. Yes.
I think that pen doesn't like you, Linda.
No, he actually said that... Sport is the continuation of war by other means, which, of course, makes the England cricket team conscientious objectors.
All that we stuff, though, in his speech, so we shall fight them on... Winston Churchill never fought on a beach except trying to get out of a deck chair. What he meant was poor people will be fighting them on the beaches.
He fought in the Boer War, though. He took loads of ludicrous risks, didn't he? I mean, I don't think you could... He wasn't backwards in coming forwards, was he, when there was a... And
sorry, I didn't know he was your big mate all of a sudden.
I'm just trying to get a little bit of historical perspective here, Jeremy. Also, he did want to go to the D-Day invasion, but the king wouldn't let him, because the king wanted to go. So Churchill said, all right, I'll fight you for it. And in the end, the generals wouldn't let any of them go, because it was their gig.
They sent Mike Yarwood instead.
They probably sent poor Norman Pickles away, didn't they?
Thanks to Alan's complete failure to be rude about the Germans, I shall give him only 1 point, which means that Alan and Jeremy end with 15 points, but Andy and Lena are winners of the last Millennium News Quiz with 16 points. Oh. We leave you with an item from BBC Online, dated from December 2036.
Today on Radio 4, 1100, The Mere Idea of You, a sitcom set on the Mir space station. 1600, Interplanetary Crown Green Bowling. 1830, The News Quiz.
Yes, and with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the Millennium News Quiz were Alan Corrin, Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy and Linda Smith. The chairman was Simon Hoggart, and the news is read by me, Charlotte Green. The chairman's script was written by Dave Cohen, Tom Jameson, and George Poles. And the producer was Lucy Armitage.